actions from there. A little bit about myself before we get started. My name's Brent Ozar. I'm a Microsoft Certified Master. Just means that I've made a whole lot of very expensive mistakes with other people's hardware, and now I can save you from making those mistakes. Also, nobody ever calls me up when things are going well. Nobody ever calls a master when, hey, we just like to talk. No, that's not how this works. I'm on Twitter. You can shoot me emails. Generally, if it's anything I can answer in 5 minutes, I'll be glad to do it. So when you're running into something ugly, feel free to give me a call. This session today is about building the fastest SQL servers. Not about just general good best practices, not about I've got a 10 gig server that's really causing me some problems. This is about trying to push the limits as far as we possibly can. Examples of some of my clients have said, well, this query runs in 20 milliseconds, I need to run it in 10. Or I've got a 25 terabyte data warehouse and I'd like my reports to finish in under 30 seconds. This is about really pushing SQL Server to the max. So some of the things that I'm going to talk about, you may say, man, who in their right mind would do this? This is about pushing things harder. A side thing I like to point out is that one of my rental cars that I've had, a Camaro SS, you know what the SS stands for, right? SQL Server, exactly. So you'll never be able to look at these cars again without going, oh yeah, that's the high performance edition. It's got SQL Server. So when I was a database administrator, I've been working with SQL Server for over 10 years. When I built SQL Servers, how I did it was I thought, well, I'm going to carefully craft things together. I'm going to measure my application. I'm going to get all these perfmon counters and DMVs to exactly measure what I thought would be the right part of set of components that would work perfectly for me. And I did everything from the hardware OS installation to the SQL Server build. And when I went live, I thought I was being even better than the manufacturer. I thought I was improving things beyond what the manufacturer would build. It's not just enough to go buy a Porsche 911. I wanted to add on spoilers and improve the engine, and I thought I was the man. I thought I was so smart with that. But let's be a little more honest. What really usually happened is that I would just haphazardly measure perfmon counters, and I wouldn't necessarily measure them at the same time the server was under load, or I couldn't afford third-party monitoring tools that would tell me what the real bottlenecks were on my servers. And I would try and guess what parts were right, but I didn't really have the time to keep up with all of the hardware news. I love bloggers like Glenn Berry, who actually write books about SQL Server hardware. These guys can tell you exactly which processor is best for your SQL Server and why. That takes an insane amount of work. How many of us really have the time to read sites like AnandTech or Tom's Hardware or Ars Technica to keep up with every advance in Xeons or memory? Not a lot of us. We really just know that solid state is fast and more memory is better. That's the kind of tuning that we like to do. And I would, because I'd be under these incredible deadlines, I would go live without testing. I didn't really have a good way of testing my applications, so I would just throw things onto hardware and I would assume they're better just because the SAN admin told me it must be fast or just because I bought something better. And I ended up with something that was a lot less impressive. Yeah. Although I will point out that you notice that they went to the extra expense of putting the Type R sticker on the back. It's a Caravelle Type R with a wooden spoiler. So we're going to do better. We're going to take a lesson from Microsoft. Let me tell you how Microsoft designed SQL Server appliances. They have people toiling away, like the SQL Cat team, if you've met with them this week. SQL Cat team is full of brilliant people. And the hardware vendors actually parachute their hardware into Microsoft and say, please tell us the best way to configure this. I've had hardware vendors approach me too, but I don't have the time to do stuff like that, the way that Microsoft does, to measure out exactly how quick any of these components can be. Microsoft distills use cases down to just a couple of common use case patterns. And I'm going to show you how to identify those with your own application. And then they pick the safest way to make these go fast without a whole lot of work. They go to the most insane depths of documentation you will ever see. I don't know about you, I'm not really fond of writing documentation. Not a big fan of that. Microsoft, on the other hand, loves documentation, and they love telling you exactly how to do something in minute detail. There are a couple of killer documents that I'm going to show you today. And what we're going to do is steal their hard work. We're going to go after all this work that they put in. They want to help you by landing these documents in your office so you can do a better job of building SQL servers. So what we're going to cover today, we're going to start by defining the two most common SQL Server use patterns so that you can understand which type of hardware you want to buy. And then we're going to look at the right hardware for each of those so that you know when you're building an OLTP server versus when you're building a decision support server, why you want to make an investment in a certain area. I'm going to recognize the server designs that I can reuse. Now, Microsoft sells, along with these hardware vendors, packaged appliances that give you everything that you need, but you may not want to buy those. I'm going to cover what they are, and I'm going to talk about how you can use this same knowledge to build these own servers in your environment with the hardware you already have. And then we're going to decide how to test our hardware so that we can see whether or not it's any better than what we started with. So we're going to get started by defining common SQL Server use patterns. OLTP, or transactional data, is a lot of very small inserts, updates, and deletes. Typically with this, we talk a lot about tables with complex relationships, foreign keys, all kinds of joins between multiple databases. And these are databases that are very quickly, very heavily accessed. Now, you're probably going to recognize some of these in your own environment. The best way to illustrate this is by looking at the other use pattern, data warehousing. Data warehouse inserts, updates, and deletes are completely different. Data warehouse inserts, updates, and deletes happen in a window overnight. We don't continuously update the data warehouse all day long. And then it's completely read-only all day. There's almost no locking and blocking. Whereas if we think back about OLTP, locking and blocking is a huge issue for us. We need to get those locks and blocks resolved as fast as we can. It's typically just a few tables. There's a sales table. There's a data warehousing reports set of tables. And the data in here never, ever goes away because people want to run reports over the last 10 years, last 20 years. And if you've ever been involved in a data warehousing project, the way that they start is they say, we're going to keep 5 years' worth of data, and then we're going to prune it out. And then guess what happens when there's 5 years' worth of data in the table? I think we could probably keep another year. I think we should probably keep going with that, because I saw down at Best Buy, hard drives only cost $200 for 2 terabytes. Why can't we store all of our history in the database? And that's okay. We can design for that, and I'll show you how. The real difference between these two use cases boils down to this. When I'm dealing in OLTP applications, I'm typically dealing with batch requests a second. It's a perfmon counter. Batch requests a second of 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, 20,000 requests per second. And these requests are very short. They're over and done with in a matter of 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, or typically the reason that you're in here is that yours take a lot longer than that and your users are getting frustrated and we want to build something faster. The second kind of server, users understand why queries take a long time. I'm going to decide today on how to build the right hardware for between those two use cases. But whenever you're building servers, I want you to throw them into one of those two buckets. Before we started, one of the questions that was asked was, am I going to cover virtualization? No, you can do virtualization with either of these use patterns. I've got a client who's doing a 10 terabyte data warehouse under virtualization, and they're okay with that because they don't need the whole thing to finish completely quickly. They don't need a 10 terabyte query to finish in under 30 seconds. They're fine with waiting a little longer for that. Here come the VMware and Hyper-V guys telling me, we can make it fast, I swear. Yes, you can, but today is about building the easiest, fastest SQL server. So now let's look at, or before we go on, does anybody have questions or an application that they think does not fit into one of those two buckets? No? How many of you are more interested in the OLTP angle? How many of you are more interested in the data warehouse angle? Oh, we got more OLTP than data warehouse. So let's talk about, what's that?
Big data.
Big data. Ah, so typically when people say the big data, Dandy's in here somewhere. Close your ears, Dandy. Dandy works for Microsoft, and I don't want him to hear this. So my whole thing with big data is that it's a buzzword, and I was going to use a different word that begins with a B. It is a buzzword. I have clients that have 25 terabyte data warehouses inside SQL Server. Buck Witte has an excellent way of saying what big data is. It's more data than you can process in the time span that you need. One way to fix big data is to build the right hardware and fix your queries. But if you do have those true tremendous 50 terabyte, 1 petabyte slice and dice use cases, you're not going to store them in one SQL Server. You're going to stripe them out across a lot and shard them across a lot. So you can think about each of those SQL Servers as being very similar to the data warehouse piece. We're just going to stripe them across a lot. It's a very good question. Any others about those use cases before we go on? All right, so we got, nope, no questions over Twitter. Somebody says, you must be a glutton for punishment for monitoring a hashtag during your talk. Yeah, it's okay, but my attendees all pay attention in the room, so it's not so bad. So let's boil SQL Server hardware down to the very simplest components. It really just boils down to these four things. We have what's on disk, we have what's in memory, we have the CPUs, and we have the end users. Now, I can't control the end users and the queries they're sending in this. This is not a performance tuning session where I'm going to tell you to stop doing select star. We're giving up on that. We're going to fix it with hardware instead. How big is your database? So let's take one of my clients, Stack Overflow, for example. Seems like a pretty big database, but their databases are around, say, 100 or 100 gigs or below. So if I've got a 100 gig database, and let's be generous and say that I can use all 64 gigs of my RAM to cache data. We know that's not true. Windows needs memory. We have execution plans in cache. We have other things in the cache. But let's just pretend all 64 gigs fit in memory, and I've got the whole database on the drives. If I issue a query that has to span the entire database, and remember, I'm going to keep it really simple here, how long will that query take? Oh, and this, let's say it's 50 gigs instead. If it's 50 gigs, the whole thing's going to fit in memory, but if it's 100 gigs, I'm going to have to pull data off the drives. And it's going to start boiling down to how fast I can get the data from drives to CPU. The way you make OLTP servers fast is really, really simple. Cache all of the data in memory. And I know you're sitting here going, "Well, duh, I already knew that." But surprisingly, our managers do not. And this is where we have to break down things into those two kinds of use cases. If you have the use case scenario where you've got to finish queries within a matter of a second or less, stop caring about your data drives. It doesn't matter whether they're RAID 5 or RAID 10, whether you're using solid state or SATA or anything like that. All that matters is we have to get the data out of memory. We have no other choice. There are no sub-second queries that are going to come off storage and scale. Now, of course, in order to cache the data in memory, at sites like Stack Overflow, we viciously monitor how much data we have, and we always try and grow the amount of memory that we have ahead of that. But it's also about pruning your data. You have to make sure you don't have extra indexes, for example. Every additional index that you have slows things down when we're trying to cache stuff in memory and we can't make it fit. If I have the classic example of a phone book, and I have one phone book that's on last name, first name, and I have another phone book that's just on last name, and some queries use the last name, first name pattern, and some queries just filter on last name, then both of those indexes will stay in memory, even though I could satisfy both of them with just one. Now, the second part of that, instant transactions, meaning a blazing fast log file. This does matter in terms of storage. Whenever I do an insert, update, or delete, SQL Server doesn't need to get the data file to disk as fast as possible. It needs to get the log to disk as fast as possible. As we're doing inserts, updates, and deletes, the first thing that SQL Server has to do is harden those changes to the log file, but it does not write the data pages to memory immediately, because you might be doing all kinds of inserts and updates and deletes against the same pages. I'm a little more tolerant of the data file being slow, but the log file cannot be slow. There is a lot of advice out on the web that will tell you all transaction logs should be isolated from the data files, right? We hear this over and over, separate your data files and your log files. The whole idea behind that was that log file access is sequential. Log file access starts at the beginning of the log, right, till we get to the end of the log, and then we start over again at the beginning. So sequential access is really fast when it's by itself on its own hard drives, but how many of you have just one database on your server? Not a lot of you. We got a few. Hey, not a lot of us. We have lots of databases on the same server, on the same spindles. That's not sequential access anymore, because all of the databases are writing to their log files at the same time. Often, I would rather have a larger pool of disks. You know how your SAN admin keeps saying you should just stripe everything across the same disks and trust me, it'll be faster? Often it will in this scenario when I'm dealing with lots of databases on the same server. But when we're really talking about building the very fastest SQL server, it is just one database per server. And in that case, for example, Stack Overflow or all recipes have just one database, for example, that's extremely transactional, and you do want to isolate it in that case. But the rest of the time, I'm going to want one big pool of disks. And then finally, if you started using read committed snapshot isolation at all, this is a silver bullet that will make a lot of locking and blocking problems go away. But to pull it off under the fastest databases, you may need a blazing fast tempdb. Because what SQL Server is doing behind the scenes, every time you issue an insert, update, or delete, SQL Server is logging those same changes over in tempdb as well. It's logging the older copies of the data over in tempdb. It's a fantastic feature because if you're doing a big select across all kinds of data and you run across a record that has changed since your query started, SQL Server smart enough to go fetch that data out of tempdb. But your load in tempdb just skyrocketed, because when you flip this feature on, suddenly tempdb is crazy with load relative to what it may have had before. When I do performance tuning talks, I like to talk about tempdb being like a public toilet. You have no idea what kind of dirty, filthy things are going on inside there. And RCSI is one of those examples. If you've got end users who like to write a lot of queries with temp tables, enabling RCSI may make your system slower instead of faster. So when I'm trying to build the fastest ones, I will use dedicated SSDs for that. Go ahead. Absolutely. So the question was, can I talk about multiple data files for tempdb? So the whole reason that we want multiple data files for tempdb isn't because we need to round robin load on storage or anything like that. There's this concept called SGAM contention, S-G-A-M, and hold on a second, I'm going to switch over to Notepad so that you can Google this. Or Bing this. Who said that? I don't know who said that. GAM contention. So you can search for SGAM contention. Now, the thing that's going on behind the scenes, and this is difficult to explain without a slide to show it, but every time that tempdb needs to allocate space, or really any database needs to allocate space for a new object, SQL Server in the past, disk space was expensive, and it would say, I'm not going to give you a whole extent. I'm not going to give you 8K pages all to yourself just for your brand new table you created, because disks are expensive, and I may not need to, you know, you may not ever put any data inside there. So it would get a shared page, a shared extent in order to make that magic happen. It'd say, well, we've got another extent here. I'm just going to grab you one page out of that. Well, in each data file, there's only one page that manages where all of these shared extents are, and it's called an SGAM page or an SGAM map. And that becomes under contention under tempdb because we're constantly creating and dropping tables. So we're adding additional files in tempdb only so that we get more places where we can track SGAMs. Sounds really stupid, but there's also trace flags that you can use to work around this as well. There was advice out on the web for a while that you should have a one-to-one for every core in your system. You should have one tempdb data file. We're learning that that's really kind of aggressive, and you probably want to start with 1/8 to 1/4 the number of cores. So I'll put that to 1/4 number of cores equals one tempdb data file. So for 16 cores, we're talking 4 to 8 data files. That is not log files. This is just data files, and this is only tempdb. There are other ways to work around this as well. If you're using magnetic drives for your tempdb, you may find that this makes them, the more files you add, the more random it gets, because you're jumping around all over the place inside these data files. So this can make your performance even worse as you start to add more data files beyond that. Does that answer your question? All right. So zip back into the presentation here. So that solves our tempdb problem. Now notice, I want to drive home, there is nothing on this slide about data drives. Nothing. Once the data's in cache, we're fairly done with that. Now there are, under really heavy load, we do still need to get the data pages out to disk. Checkpoints may take a while, but this is not the first place you want to start. I see so many DBAs paranoid about RAID 5 versus RAID 10, the number of data files that they have. Your problem or your solution is not screwing around with storage. And I'm going to give you an extreme example because I checked prices just again this morning. I like to check them all the time. 128 gigs of RAM is less than $2,000. How much was your conference ticket? And you came here to learn, oh, I got to learn about how to make my stuff faster. If you have a database that's less than 100 gigs, you could write a $2,000 check and boom, you're done. 384 gigs of memory this morning for an HP DL380 was less than $6,000. 384 gigs of memory, less than $6,000. That's pretty cheap. Now it does hit a hockey stick as you start to get into large densities of memory. 768 gigs in that same HP DL380 is $52,000. Which brings us into our next problem, our data warehouse scenario. I am not going to be able to cache that guy in memory. If we look at, we've got a 500 gig data file, even if I throw a lot of data in there, I'm still screwed. I mean, even if I throw a lot of memory in there, I'm still screwed. Because I can only cache, if I'm lucky, half of that table. So when somebody does a fact table scan across that 500 gigs, the length of time it'll take the query to finish is the length of time it takes to get the remaining 250 gigs off storage and into the CPU. So the right hardware for the fastest data warehousing scenarios is a little different. I can't cache that in memory, so I kind of sort of got to give up. I mean, there hits a point where I can say, really, at the end of the day, I'm not going to cache the whole thing, and what's in memory is going to keep changing anyway. But I really have to do the part in red. I have got to maximize storage throughput in order to get things off disk as fast as I can. This is where it starts to get really expensive. This is why I caution people when you're dealing with performance tuning, if you can fit the database in memory, please do. If you can do it for less than, say, $20,000, you should do that, because the stuff we're about to talk about is $500,000 solutions and up. Suddenly that $50,000 for RAM doesn't seem all that bad relative to the server designs we're getting ready to talk about. So I'm not going to talk about how to do the fastest OLTP servers, because this stuff's pretty straightforward. You just throw the flux capacitor in, stuff the thing full of memory, and off you go into the future. Things are going to be blazing quick. The problem that we're going to run into is the data warehousing scenario, when I need to get the data off of disk as fast as I can. Fortunately, this is where Microsoft's references really start to come in handy. And I'm going to show you three documents that Microsoft and its hardware partners have put together, and I'm going to show you how we're going to learn from these. This is your secret weapon when you go back to your managers. When they say, why isn't the SQL Server fast? How come you can't make it faster? What's in here is about to be a huge sanity check. When you look at the amount of hardware we're about to talk about, it's going to scare the pants off of some people. Please stay seated. I don't want to see you without your pants. So You can download this. This particular one is for SQL Server 2012, but Microsoft has others for SQL 2008, 2008 R2, and we've got a lot of partner vendor documentation as well. If you go to brennozar.com/go/fastdw, it'll get you straight to this Microsoft landing page. The Fast Track Data Warehouse Reference Architecture, easy for you to say, Data Warehouse Reference Architecture. They have several Fast Track Reference Architectures, but the one that I want you to take home to management is the data warehouse reference architectures, because it really helps drive home how fast storage needs to be. Fast Track is a set of solutions by Microsoft where the idea is that you just tell them how big your databases are and they point you to some hardware. You say, I have a 2 terabyte data warehouse, what should I buy? And there's an approved solutions list from HP, Dell, IBM, and so forth. What's awesome with this is that we can reuse all of this documentation. So now I'm going to switch into Microsoft Word, and we're actually going to look a little deeper into this guy. All right, so we're going to zoom in. I am going to go to page width. So blah, 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 technical article, geniuses, woohoo! But we'll go down further. Yeah, really, really geniuses. And this sounds like a marketing piece, I got to be honest. Audience, Fast Track Data Warehouse, Fast Track Value Proposition. Here's where things start to get cool. The holistic component architecture. This is the marketing savvy way of what I just explained. That storage interconnect is like the holy grail here. Our connection between our SQL Server and our storage becomes incredibly important, because we can't cache these databases in memory. We had to give up on that because our database hit that kind of size. This whole document requires very different component architectures to achieve balance. What does balance mean? Balance means, why is Microsoft charging $7,000 per core? We really freak out at this Enterprise Edition licensing thing. People say, oh man, oh my gosh, it's going to cost me $1 million to license this big SQL Server. That's because you didn't need that big SQL Server. Your real problem, the reason that so many of these big queries don't finish fast, is the storage interconnect and is the storage underneath it. I have clients with very, very, very small SQL Servers with very large data sets, but it works wonderfully because they balanced the CPU and the storage. Instead of thinking about spending $500,000 in SQL Server licensing per SQL Server, we need to start looking at the stuff on the right-hand side. And we need to start looking at it in a whole lot more detail. So we're going to scroll down. It, of course, talks about the data warehouse access patterns, blah, blah, blah. This just means that we're going to be scanning the entire table. Use case, read mostly, which is again what we're talking about here. When the database is too big to fit in memory, we're mostly talking about reads. It's not like you write 10 terabytes a day, right? These things don't update themselves all the time. And then choosing a configuration. Now, they go into, let me go way down, this section right here. Maximum CPU core consumption rate. What this means is how fast can your SQL Server CPUs digest data? There are formulas in here for how you go about testing it and calculating it, and I know how you are. You are too busy to go through and calculate these yourselves because you have to go out and do important things like attend conferences and tweet while you're sitting in there. Because you're too busy for that, I'm going to give you the number that I usually use as a general baseline no matter what the CPUs are, and that's 200 megabytes per second. 200 megabytes per second is a good general number to start with for maximum CPU core consumption rate. If you have ever done any storage testing on any kind of storage gear that you have, I bet you're probably getting, well, let's ask, how many of you have tested your storage throughput? All right. How many of you have gotten more than 200 megabytes per second? More than 400 megabytes per second? More than 600 megabytes per second? So almost everybody in the room, except my best friend over there who traveled thousands of miles to come see me, and he got my business card yesterday and said it's going to impress his wife. And I was like, you're what? What? So If you're talking about everybody in this room could be satisfied with less than a quad core. No, that's not true. I have very high CPU use. Yeah, you think you do. When we start fixing storage, you're going to be surprised at how differently things act. So, and it goes into whole details about how you calculate this for your servers, but before you go off and do this, because you probably don't have spare hardware that you can go and calculate this stuff on, we're going to bail out of the Microsoft document, and we're going to switch over to something else, which is Dell and HP have built all kinds of documentation for their own systems. This particular one is, let me jump up to the top, Dell's reference configuration for a SQL 2008 R2 fast track data reference architecture using a Power Vault, whatever. You're going to go through and find just a few documents from Dell, HP, IBM, whoever, to satisfy the kinds of throughput that you want. They tell you, hey, we're following fast track data warehouse reference architecture. Here's the performance benchmark that we're doing. Here's our conclusion. And let's go through and look at what it is that they're doing here. They get pretty specific. They tell you where to plug the cables in. This matters. This matters a lot. To the point where when you validated one of these architectures, because you buy, the idea is that you're going to go contact Dell or HP or IBM or whoever, you're going to go buy exactly the part numbers that they list, and they tell you down to every port how many cables that you need, how many drives that you need. We're going to look at the drives thing here in a minute. And then they tell you exactly how to plug it in, because this does change performance. If I had a dollar for every time I went to a client and said, hey, the SAN guy, as it turns out, he thought he knew what he was doing. He was going by best practices, but it's not right for SQL Server, for us trying to get a whole lot of throughput out. Well, that's actually not true. I have a lot more than a dollar for every time I've gone and done that. But it's good work if you can get it. So it gives you exactly the HBAs that you need. It tells you exactly the firmware that you need. And it tells you, go further down, how to set everything, every single thing in the BIOS. And they even tell you in SQL Server what configuration settings you should use. RAID stripe sizes, how you do the LUNs. So if you've ever done storage and you know your SAN admin says, hey, trust me, it should all be one big pool of disks. It is all going to be fine. Not when you get to this level of performance. When we get to this level of performance, the hardware vendor is saying each one of these LUNs is going to have a different data file for the same database. So I've got one big massive database, and I'm going to spread the load across multiple files. Each file is going to live on a different LUN. You know what each LUN maps up to? One CPU core. So you think about, man, wow, I've got a 20-core server. Yeah, forget hyper-threading for a minute. We'll assume that that's separate. We've got a 20-core server. You think about the number of LUNs you're going to need, the amount of throughput that you're going to need. And I bet if you're anything like me, as a database freak, you're going, RAID 5? What? Well, remember that we're talking about trying to pull as much data out as fast as we can, and there's a cost and performance benefit here, cost and performance trade-off. If I did RAID 10 for 20 LUNs, I just got a whole lot more expensive, right? Now, if I'm doing all my writes overnight in a data warehouse scenario, I can get by with this. But again, remember, for data warehousing, the designs are different from OLTP. If we're doing OLTP, buy the memory, cache the entire database in memory, and then some, and you're pretty much done. So we're going to go on even further. Gives you the, whoops, I went a little too far, the trace flags and startup switches for SQL Server, and they explain what they mean. Now, by now, you're starting to get the picture of, wow, this is actually pretty educational, and it's not just a hardware configuration management guide. You can use this for your own hardware and your own SQL servers. You don't have to buy this stuff. You can just plagiarize their manuals. Woo-hoo! I'm all about plagiarism. And then they're saying on Twitter, just throw the flux capacitor in, and tuning SQL is easy. The whole thing goes in RAM, and the tempDB is a public toilet. Yes, my favorite line. So now it goes further. It talks about the number of LUNs that you need, which storage processor that they need to live on. And the further we get down to here, it even shows you how to configure the switches. Now, generally, these kinds of appliances are bought as standalone solutions. They're not sharing SAN switches with anything else. They're not sharing any storage capacity or infrastructure with anything else. But we probably don't have the money to do that. We're going to piggyback on top of our own SAN switching infrastructure. But we're going to hand this to our SAN guy so that he understands this. Look at the numbers going across the top. This is where the balanced part comes in, right? Because we're balancing the amount of throughput that our CPUs can consume, how much the storage processor can deliver, because if you've sat through sessions, EMC, NetApp, you know, HP, all those guys, they talk a lot about their SAN's performance, and they'll say things like the magic SAN pixie dust takes care of everything. That's because if you buy it right, it really does. The SAN controller can handle that much. But what happens when you buy SAN storage is that your executives go in a room with their sales guys, and they start talking about golf games, and at the end of it, they're saying, well, what can I get for $250,000? And that number drops dramatically. When we hand this to our SAN guy and say, I need to get 3,000 megabytes per second, and how many of us were earlier raising our hand saying, I got 200 or 400, woo-hoo-hoo. That's why. This is why we're not having this balanced configuration of how much the storage processor can deliver and how much each disk group can deliver. So notice in here we've got two storage controllers and all these LUNs that are going down across the bottom. So then, and they give you the instructions on how to calculate the MCR, the maximum consumption rate. This is where I don't want you to bother with it on your own systems. You're not going to have the kind of lab to set this together. Just start with 200 megabytes per core. Check this little fella out. He's able to do a little faster, 345 megabytes a second per core. And earlier, remember, we were saying we only get 200 or 400 megabytes per second, period, no matter how many cores we have. Licensing isn't the problem. Memory isn't the problem in this case. It's how fast can we get stuff off of storage, and our storage is nowhere fast enough. Dell isn't the only one doing this. HP also does a fantastic job with this. This one's a little larger, an HP ProLiant DL980 G7. So this is a big four-socket monster if I go further down. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. How many times have we gone off and said, oh, I need to buy a four-socket SQL CPU server? No, you don't. No, you really don't. You think you do, but you don't. Often, we think our stuff is bottlenecked by CPU. The bigger problem is all those expensive things down across the bottom, which, of course, are in the days of old magnetic storage. In magnetic storage, I really did need huge racks full of storage. But as we're starting to test now with more things like Fusion IO, OCZ, RAMSAN, OCZ has a drive out called the Z drive that does 2,000 megabytes per second in one drive by itself. So just one solid-state PCI Express drive, 2,000 megabytes per second for reads, writes, sequential, random, you name it, it outblows all of this stuff just by itself. Now, if you've been seduced by the siren song of all these PCI Express solid-state vendors that have been out, the OCZs, the Fusion IOs, the RAMSANs, the scary part of some of this is that they're PCI Express card drives that plug straight into the server. Some of these vendors will say, it's like a SAN in the palm of your hand. Well, sure it is. How many of you have had a SAN go down? Yeah. Please don't call me, you people, when that happens. SANs go down, they all have everything has single points of failures until we get up in the $1 million range. If you do a PCI Express solid state drive, get two. Mirror across both of them, even if you're doing it for tempDB, because these drives do fail. Don't get freaked out that they fail more than magnetic drives, because look how many of these are going to fail over time, and we're accustomed and used to that. We've all had hard drive failures, and that hasn't been such a big deal. So it goes in, and it tells us much more than that. It goes through and says, this is another thing I like about the fast track reference architecture, read the numbers down the right side, the recommended maximum capacity. Fast track architectures don't get much better than this. They say if your data is this big, this is the server that you need. I've had executives say, well, those guys are just trying to sell hardware and licensing. They're just trying to get, you know, pad their own pockets. No, if Microsoft is going up in a deal against Oracle or DB2, you had better believe they want their costs to be lower than Oracle, and that includes the hardware costs. So these are not just go throw a whole bunch of hardware in and forget it. And look at the CPU counts. Two CPUs, 20 terabyte max capacity. This is stuff that really makes a genuinely different approach to performance tuning. 12 cores for 20 terabytes. 12 cores! This is why Microsoft can actually say, Enterprise Edition, yeah, it's $7,000 a core. But the thing is, you really don't need as many cores as you thought you did, especially with always-on availability groups. I do a lab this afternoon at 1 o'clock over by registration where you get to put your hands on always-on availability groups, and you can fail over nodes back and forth. The whole idea is that we're going to scale out servers for reads. We're going to buy additional SQL servers and use them in for reads. I don't need to buy one monster 4-socket, 8-socket box. I can get away with a whole lot less. Any questions on this so far? See a lot of head scratching. Oh my God, I bought too many CPU cores. Nothing else on Twitter. Nope, we're good there. You guys are just live tweeting. You're not even asking questions. All right, cool. So going down through the rest of this, the DL980, storage options, all of these vendors do the exact same thing. Maximum consumption rate, 18 gigabytes per second across 80 CPU cores. I don't ever want to see anybody buying a 4-socket or 8-socket SQL server without reading these documentation and understanding that if you can't deliver 18 gigabytes per second out of storage, you're wasting your money. We go on through capacity summary and the number of drives that you need. Yeah, it's a lot. Get over it. All right, so we'll switch back. So that's where you can go and get those documents. It's a very simple framework for vendors. Microsoft has already done all the hardware or homework for you. And now, all you have to do is focus on that simple little diagram and say, how many cores do I have? How many megabytes per second am I going to need to deliver? And how incredibly crappily slow is my storage? I've also got a few notes in there just so that you guys have for later as you go through, because I won't be there helpfully informing you about reading those documentations. We'll skip on through. Your hardware does way less than you think. When we start going in and testing this, this is a fantastic poster by Kendra Little, one of my business partners, and it shows you down the left-hand side the different standards for I/O, all the way down to 10 gig iSCSI, and the time that it takes to transmit 1 gig. Remember our 500 gig scenario. If I have a 500 gig database, how long does it take to transfer 500 of those gigs? Well, on 8 gig fiber channel, at 1.2 seconds per gig, I'm looking at 500 seconds just to get the data off of storage. This is why SQL Server is sitting around. It's the bandwidth, the bottleneck between our servers and the SAN. It's trying to drink a whole lot of data through a really tiny straw. And our typical storage throughput sucks. This is a popular tool, and I'm going to show you how to use it here in a minute, Crystal Disk Mark. And this is very typical with what I see at clients. We've been talking about thousands of megabytes per second, and I asked you guys what you wanted for testing, or what you got for testing, and you got extremely poor results. Go ahead. Oh, yes, let me jump back to you. Yes. Oh, no, I'll show you more of that. I'll show you more detail. I mean, if you want to see how bad one of my clients' storage is, you can take pictures, but I got way worse storage than that. Man, it's really, so as a result of this, one of the things that you get out of doing consulting is that you learn how to tell really funny stories. So when you go back and you test your storage, I want you to have a USB flash drive as well, because I bet you got a lot of them from vendors. And then I want you to compare those numbers with Crystal Disk Mark against your SAN. And then you can go back and say to your SAN admin, good news, I can double our SAN performance. I got this free from TechEd. Yeah. Oh. So now we need to talk about how to test our own hardware. When I'm building really fast cars, I go and put them on a dyno. A dyno will sit there and tell me exactly how much horsepower a given car has. With Crystal Disk Mark is like a dyno for our storage. totally free tool, and it's safe to run in production, but not while SQL Server is on. This will push a tremendous amount of I/O through your storage. You only want to do this on a machine that is connected to the SAN, but not live at the same time SQL Server is running. There are crappy SANs out there that this will cause it to fail if you push it really hard. Now, which brings up an interesting question. If I give you a tool that I tells you that I tell you will take down your SAN if you run it, should you ever run it? Well, when I was a database administrator and I ran these tools, I liked doing them during the middle of the day. Because when the SAN admin freaked out, I'd be like, well, what? A simple program that I ran took the SAN down? Really? That doesn't sound like we have a very good SAN. That sounds like you have a problem. And I'm not condoning that behavior. There's a reason that I'm not a database administrator anymore. Now, when you run this, it's really simple. No installation is required. You can get a portable version of it and run it from a network drive. I like to just save it on a network share, and that way I can run it from any server. And there's three drop-downs across the top. The first one that's showing 5 in this diagram is the number of passes we're going to run. The more passes that we run, the more consistent data that we get, because we don't want any weird transitory event to take up our results. So I'm going to do at least 5 passes, and you can do up to 9. The next box down there is the size of my test file. And unfortunately, this only goes up to 4,000 megs, and I want to use the biggest test file I can, because your database is larger than the SAN's cache. And if we're just testing the SAN's cache, we're not really testing anything, or the RAID controller's cache. And then finally, the last drop-down is the drive letter that you're going to use. Sad trombone, this does not work with mount points. So if you're using mount points, you're going to have to test this on drive letters instead. As soon as you pick those three things, you can just hit the All button, and immediately Crystal Disk Mark goes off, and it takes about 5 minutes to gather all these test results. Now, a lot of these test results have nothing to do with SQL Server. The only ones that do are the top row, which is sequential. Sequential is big, long table scans, backups, DBCCs, index rebuilds, these big, huge operations, or in the case of data warehouses, table scans, very important. So how long does it take me to really get a lot of data out of the SAN? Then skip all the way down to the bottom number, 4K queue depth of 32. That's the QD32, means we're sending 32 operations at any given time out to our storage. Now, you SQL Server gurus out there will understand that SQL Server doesn't work in 4K increments. It works in 8K increments or larger. With exceptions, there are things that we do with the log file that can be smaller. But the thing at the bottom is a decent spoof of OLTP databases and TempDB. This is the easy button of storage testing. You run this, you're done in 5 minutes, and you have a pretty screenshot that you can take to your SAN admin. And pro tip, if you click edit, copy, it gives it all to you in a text format so that you can copy paste it into an email and throw your SAN admin under the bus. Did I say that out loud? I think I said that out loud. So when you do this, you go back to your storage administrator and you say, here's the deal. I got a 8-core SQL Server. I'm supposed to be able to hit 1,600 megabytes a second of throughput, and I'm not getting anywhere near that much, because I guarantee you, your charts won't look anywhere near that pretty. Go ahead, in the back. You don't, actually. That's a great question. Do you get any estimated time how long this test is going to take? The longer that it takes to write out the test file, the longer it'll take. So the funny part is, the crappier the storage is, the longer it'll take to set up. Typically, you're looking at about 5 minutes. So the question was, do we need downtime on production to run this? Generally, I would run this on a separate server like development or QA that's roughly similar to production. I would do it, at whatever time is convenient. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. So the question was, if we've got production and development servers that are different in hardware capacity, do I need production downtime to do it? Yes. Yeah, unfortunately, you do. And this is where, when we circle back to, at the beginning, I talked about building the fastest SQL servers. It's not just about building anyone's. It's about building the Cadillac stuff. Not that Cadillac is the fastest, although I like the CTSV. But generally, if I'm going to push the limit as hard as I can, I have got to have a load test environment that's the same size. And I go back to the business and I say, here's the deal. For me to do this troubleshooting, I'm going to need 5 minutes of downtime. How much does that cost the business? It's a lot? Great. I need to start getting a load test environment so we can skip those, or so we can test those. Go ahead. A wonderful question. The question was, does NTFS allocation unit stripe size make any difference when we're trying to tune performance? Yes, and the fast track data warehouse reference architectures tell you what the stripe size should be and NTFS allocation unit size should be. If you haven't heard of those terms before, stripe size and NTFS allocation unit size, go to, I'm going to fire up my text pad again just so that you guys can write down the link. My setup checklist is at brentozar.com/go/setup. brentozar.com/go/setup will tell you what the NTFS allocation unit size means and how you should go about configuring that when you set up your storage. Another sad trombone moment, the only time you can configure these values is when you set up your SQL server from scratch. So often, as a consultant, I come in and say, your storage stuff is all wrong, NTFS allocation unit size is wrong, stripe size is wrong, we're just going to fix this in the next version. If you're thinking about doing any 2012 upgrades or whatever, please, for the love of all that's bacon, go to that setup checklist and do it before you do the install, because there's stuff you can never do afterwards. Go ahead. Yes, the question was, did Windows ever change partition offset, which are alignment that was a problem back in Windows 2003 and earlier? That is fixed in 2008 and newer. But it's only fixed for volumes we create in 2008 and newer. So if you take a volume that was on a Windows 2003 box and you attach it to a 2008 box, it's not fixed, that's also covered in the setup checklist. Other questions? Oh, we got all, man, everybody wants to do setups. Yes, go ahead. Yes, that turns into stop once all starts, or you can just close the app and you're good. So once the SAN admin comes in and starts going, what's going on here, you can close that and go, I don't know. Yes, go ahead. Ooh, great question. So which of these metrics correlates with the MCR? Because MCR, the maximum consumption rate, is large table scans, how much can SQL Server digest quickly, it's really the top left number, which is large sequential reads. That's my best case scenario. For OLTP, which is closer to what the bottom one means, I would generally want to get it out of RAM anyway, so I'm not as worried about that. There's another? No more questions? All right, good. Not that questions are bad. Questions are, oh, hey, how's it going? Never. No. Oh, so the question was, do these tips still apply under virtualization? Absolutely. Even to the point where, so the Crystal Disk Mark, the next tool that I'm going to show you, the performance testing tools all still apply. SQL Server's maximum consumption rate still applies. For every virtual core we give it, we still need to be able to saturate that much data. So that's an excellent question. All right, so this is the easy button of SAN testing, or storage testing, period. And you're going to get a very fast idea, just a sanity check, of how bad things are. Then, if it passes the sanity check, the deeper level of testing I like is SQL.io. Go ahead. Yeah. Yes. Ooh, so the question was, do we have a similar number for MCR under virtualization, maximum consumption rate? Oh, this is where licensing gets a little tricky. So VMware's licensing and Hyper-V's licensing prohibit you from publishing benchmarks without getting their approval because there are so many bad tests. I've seen so many people publish benchmarks and I look at their configuration, I'm like, what are you thinking? I would, you just change these three things and it'll be amazing. So I haven't seen anybody publish anything. You could use the same numbers, 150, 200 megabytes per second. You'll be fairly unlikely to get those metrics from underlying storage, only because usually when I see people deploy virtualization, they're trying to cut costs. And so they get 1 gig iSCSI, 2 gig fiber, they oversubscribe blades and so forth. So you can use the same metric, I would just caution that you're not gonna get anywhere near that kind of performance. You bet. So SQLIO is the slow version of storage testing. Storage testing, slow jam. By now you've read through all the notes on there. Using a large test file is very important, and I cover how to set that up in my instructions. In the results, it produces this big monstrous text file. The only numbers that you care about are the ones that are in red. And my girlfriend tells me they're in red. I'm red-green colorblind, so I just take her word for it. She could write all kinds of things in alternate colors on the slides, and I would never know. This man doesn't do the laundry right. So the ones that matter, really, in terms of maximum consumption rate, is that megabytes per second, which is what we're aiming for with our maximum consumption rate. And in my SQLIO tutorial, I give you a bunch of different parameters to use with SQLIO, not because I'm trying to mimic SQL Server's performance, but because I'm trying to get the best performance out of the storage no matter what parameters I use. I just want to do a sanity check and say, is this storage hot or not? You know, give me a ballpark number at the end of the day. Your goals is to first test with Crystal Disk Mark, make sure you get a sanity check number, and then try two simultaneous Crystal Disk Marks against two different drive letters. Often with storage multipathing, we're able to push a different drive's traffic through a different path. So if I have two iSCSI network cables, or if I have two fiber optic network cables, I may be able to get twice the bandwidth by running two simultaneous tests. If I don't, if my throughput goes in half when I run two tests at once, we know that we have a problem. We know that we're not going to be able to push more load out of the storage that way. And you want to do all of this before you install SQL Server. In a perfect world, I know that we talk about we're going to have to take down production in order to improve these things. What I want to get you towards is before you build that SQL 2012 box, test this stuff, and it'll make a huge difference. But storage is not the only solution. There's a lot of ways that we could improve memory. We could do better jobs with our indexes. All kinds of things that we can do for performance tuning. And you've learned a lot of those things this week, probably, especially if you sat through the SQL Server pre-con with Denny and Tom. But the one I'm going to hit on is the last one, merry-go-round scans with Enterprise Edition. A lot of managers don't understand just how important Enterprise Edition's performance improvements are when we're really trying to push the limit. And I want to give you guys this slide deck so that you can understand how to take this home to management and say, see, Enterprise really is different. It's not that just Microsoft uses a nicer glove when they reach in for our wallet. It actually is better. So let's say that we've got a table sales. That's 1 terabyte table, very large, and I'm going to have to do a query of it. But unfortunately, it doesn't fit in memory because my manager got cheap, and I've only got, say, 128 gigs worth of memory in my SQL Server. So my query starts off, and it's scanning through this table, but the table is larger than will fit in memory, so I'm going to have to read it from disk. And as I'm reading along, this stuff is not staying in memory. It's flushing out of memory because I keep reading more and more data. If my server had 1 terabyte of memory, this wouldn't be a problem, but the idea is that different pages of memory keep going through for the same query. As I'm running my query, halfway in, Dandy turns around and runs a similar query against the same table. Because he copies everything I do, trust me. He's just this total copycat. So his query starts up and runs along, but what's cool about Enterprise Edition is it figures out, someone else is running a query against the same table. I can piggyback off the reads they're doing and just read those same pages through memory as our queries go along together, holding hands and dancing through the field, reading our pages simultaneously. And when my query finishes, notice that he hasn't read all of the pages. SQL Server's smart enough to say, well, all right, I'm going to have to go back to the beginning for Dandy's query. This is SQL Server Type R. This is Enterprise Edition. And this is the only way you can get big queries to scale. Because imagine if you didn't have Enterprise Edition, if you tried to get away with Standard, and the same trick happens, and 10 people fire off 10 different queries at once against the same tables that don't fit in memory, you're going to be hammering the bejesus out of that storage. Merry-go-round scans do make a tremendous difference in terms of storage throughput and performance. So to recap everything that we covered today, first we defined the two most common SQL Server use cases. OLTP really just means I need this query to finish instantaneously. Data warehousing queries mean I need it to finish in, say, 30 seconds. Anytime it's not instantaneous means I'm going to have to hit disk. Disk means a huge difference in the way we design servers, and I give you the fast track data warehouse reference architecture documents so that you can go through and show those to your manager and say, see, this is why we can't have nice things. We learned how to test our own hardware and compare it to those data warehouse solutions and see how our storage fits as opposed to those. And then finally, remember that storage is not the only solution. When you really do want to push SQL Server as hard as you can, Enterprise is a no-brainer, not just because of the 64 gig limit on Standard Edition, but also because of things like merry-go-round scans. And then as long as we follow all of those, the cars that we build, we will all be winners, or wieners. So everything I want to point out, one other thing on the track resources, we have a lab this afternoon. If you're big into performance tuning, check out the labs over by the registration desk at 1 o'clock, because I'll be showing people how to do always-on availability groups, which is a great way to scale out. Please, for the love of all that's bacon, turn in your session evaluations. I'm going to go ahead and take questions, but I want to mention that because it's really important, not just for this session, but for all of our sessions, because we live and die by our feedback. So now, questions. And if you've got questions and you don't want to yell, you can stand at a microphone even if somebody else is, you know, up there, and I'll just call you whenever your turn comes. Go ahead. Who was you? Were there? You go. Yes, I didn't mention anything about network I/O. So typically, if we've got the queries that are doing select star from large tables or blob objects, there's only one way to get it out the door, and that's with network teaming. You want to team multiple network cards together or go with 10 gig Ethernet, and there's not really a lot of tuning that we're going to do on the SQL side in order that would do anything near as much of a difference as 10 gig iSCSI will. I'm not a big fan of, so I'd like to say that in modern airplanes are so advanced that there's really only two things in the cockpit. There's the pilot and there's the dog. It's the pilot's job to feed the dog. It's the dog's job to bite the pilot if he touches anything. SQL Server doesn't have a dog. And so there's a lot of us who will go in there and tweak and tune settings, think we're going to make a difference. Generally, the only way I would change things like network packet size is if I test before and after, guarantee that it works all the way through and actually improves performance instead of making it worse. 99 times out of 100, it doesn't make a bit of difference. Go ahead. Yes. Jumbo frames for storage, I'm all for it. So for iSCSI, the question was, how do I feel about jumbo frames? For iSCSI, it's great, but for the client-side networking, it doesn't work. Yeah, so, yeah, just for iSCSI, it's wonderful. Yes. Go ahead. Fighter pilot. He's a fighter pilot, yes.
I don't agree with your message. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah,
so baselines are so important because so often we'll go in and users will say the query's slow. Well, why is it slow? What changed? The killer thing about shared storage is that your SAN admin can change anything, anytime he wants, and you have no idea. It is so important to run tools like SQLIO to establish a baseline before your SQL Server goes live so that 2 months later or 6 months later, when people say queries are slow, you want to rerun those same tests during a maintenance window or a Windows patch window or patch update, because if you don't get the same SQLIO numbers, you know that your storage administrator did something wrong, applied a firmware upgrade incorrectly, changed a setting in the back end, and we have no idea. That baseline is so important. Because otherwise, when you go to troubleshoot something and you run these tests, you're just like, I don't know if anything was better or worse. Yeah. Go ahead.
When you're
Yeah, that is a wonderful question. So if we run storage testing, I'm trying to get past all that so we got that eval slide up. If we have a shared piece of storage and we run tests against on one of the servers, it's development, QA, whatever, but it's on the same shared storage as production, will it impact it? Oh, yes, yes. Typically, it's not going to impact cache as bad because storage gear is relatively good at segregating the cache impact. But if it's one big pool of drives, it may impact storage. Yes. Go ahead. Great question. Do I run SQLIO against all drives or just pick two or three? Generally, because I'm paranoid, I will run it on drives of different sizes at least. So if somebody gives me a 100 gig drive and a 1 terabyte drive, I'm going to run the tests against both because some storage will allocate how much cache you get by the size of the drive. And I know that my SAN admin may be putting them on different RAID levels, other stuff like that. As long as I get those tests in, I'm generally fine. I don't test every drive. More questions? Oh, nope, taking pictures. No? Yes. Oh, go ahead. Yes. So let me turn back and ask, why do they do that instead of doing, say, virtualization? That's a great question. The question was, why would I run virtual instead of running just 20 instances on the same box? So virtualization lets me cap CPU and memory per instance and move it around from place to place and change Windows settings on a SQL server by SQL server level. So often I'll get those bozo application admins who want to remote desktop into the server and make changes. I can let them do that under virtualization. I can't do it on an instance with or a SQL server with 20 instances. In Windows, I do have some tools that will let me confine how much CPU or memory a particular instance gets, but they're nowhere near as fine-grained as what I get under virtualization. Virtualization will automatically hop instances between cores based on load. With SQL Server affinity masking, I'm picking specific cores and my hands are tied. Unless I have an insane number of cores, I'm really running into problems. So. And that brings an interesting question, too, just for multiple instances, because I get this a lot under virtualization. If you do use virtualization, I never recommend putting more than one instance per VM. Just it gives you so much more flexibility to separate out every instance into its own VM for performance tuning, security, and management down the road. Yes, go ahead. Can I explain that? So this is a little more in detail than I want to go into in this session. If you want to come up afterwards, I have a slide deck just for that, and we can go through. You don't understand which? Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. So the notepad, I'll pull the note back up. If you have, so the number of cores, another way I'll write it, so cores divided by 4 equals number of tempdb data files. Here's that. What's that? So this is now a passionate religious debate. There are people who are all over the place. Some people will say you should start with 4 files, period. There are some people who say you should start with 2 files, period. There are people who say you should start with 1 for every core. This is really, you know, it's like chosen food, I guess. You know, as long as you're not going 1-to-1 per core and you're not just going 1 tempdb data file, and even 1 tempdb data file can be totally okay for you if you're not running into tempdb contention. Generally, when you see people give these ranges, it's because they personally have had a lot of problems with tempdb contention. So they'll go, oh, you should have 8. You know, I've seen a lot of problems, trust me. Well, I've also have situations where I've seen lots of people with no problems with 1 data file. It's the old horrible thing to say, SQL Server, and I hate saying this as a presenter, is it depends. You want to adjust this based on the kind of tempdb scam contention that you're seeing in your environment. So the question was, does it exclude hyperthreading? No. Every hyperthread is the same to SQL Server as if it's an actual, got a logical processor there to itself. Those are considered real processors there. Yes, yes. Go ahead. Who was, open up?
Is there a DMV or something that tells you this is your contention is an issue?
Ooh, there's a lot of good DMVs that will tell you stuff like that. If you go to brentozar.com/go/DMVs, I've got DMV analysis queries that'll go into things like weight stats, and they'll tell you whether or not you're bottlenecking on that. Go ahead. The question was, is that only an issue once you start, this object is to a certain size and you start allocating full extents? No, it's actually the opposite. The reason why it's a problem is because they start very small and only allocate one page at a time, and we have to keep going back and getting shared pages initially. Once we start allocating whole extents, this is no longer a problem. Yes, okay, then that, yep. And there's also trace flags you can turn on so the SQL Server will allocate whole extents as well from the get-go. If any SGAM questions, we'll do those after the session, just to, so that we can do that separately with a separate slide deck. Yes, go ahead. I do. So here I am with my Go codes again, brentozar.com/go/perfmon. The question was, do I have, yes. You do enough blogging and you're like, I've written about that too. I've written about that. The question was, do I have a list of my favorite perfmon counters? Yes, I have a set on there along with like an hour long video from a conference explaining how that works. Oh, yes. It's pointing over. Oh man, I never got over that side. Yes. They love your question. No, huh? What I will say is the question was about performance tools and monitoring tools. I used to think when I was a database administrator, I was very proud of the fact that I rolled everything myself and I did all these perfmon scripts and WMI queries and things. Now looking back, I'm like, why did I reinvent the wheel? There are so many good tools out there that are either cheap or open source. So just go out and check, even at the show floor, there are tons of vendors. I know they seem slimy from the outside, but they're real people. I worked for one and I liked them a lot. But there's a ton of stuff out there. For around $1,000 a server, you can get incredible detail of what's going on inside your server. And that way you know when anything happens around the clock. So yes, in the back. Oh, great question. How much RAM should we allocate for the OS? I have that in my setup checklist in brentozar.com/go/setup, which I think was up at the top. Oh, no, it wasn't. Where did I put it, down the bottom? There it is, down at the bottom. brentozar.com/go/setup. My general rule is I'll go with either 4 gigs or 10%, whichever is larger, not smaller, whichever is larger. That is very conservative. I like to leave a lot of memory for the OS because I know so many people who love to go in and surf the web from the SQL Server. So to each his own. Oh, we got all good. Nope, nope. Oh, yes, go ahead. Question was, what about settings for processor affinity? That's one of those pilot and the dog things that I don't like touching. Anytime I feel like I want to go into processor affinity, that's a clue that I want virtualization, that I want to be able to allocate stuff at a VMware level or Hyper-V level instead, rather than trying to set it inside SQL Server.
What you're saying is that in the case of processor affinity,
mm-hmm.
the default is the best.
Yes, for me, the default is the best. There is, if you want to learn about really high throughput I/O, where you actually do have to change processor affinity, search for that guy's blog. Thomas Kaiser has a bunch of excellent posts. He used to be a member of SQL CAT team, and he's designed for very high throughput I/O, where he'll even set off certain CPUs for the network card, leave certain CPUs individually for the network card. Yes, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Oh, that's a great question. How do I decide when, as the database gets larger, how do I decide when to add data files versus just splitting certain things out into their own file groups? So before I hit the 1 terabyte level, I like to have 4 files in every file group. So for every file group, I've got 4 files in it. This helps the storage guys do multipathing easier. If I put each one of those files on a separate drive letter, there's multipathing software out there like EMC PowerPath that makes that problem go away, but if you don't have that, that's the easiest way to let your SAN guy get you more performance through. I generally speaking don't like separating data and indexes, things like that, onto different file groups because there's no inheritance in SQL Server. Just because I set it today doesn't mean that tomorrow somebody's not going to use the database tuning advisor, index tuning wizard, whatever, add additional indexes, put them on the wrong file group, and then I'm screwed. I have to go back and move them again. So generally I'm not a big fan of doing stuff like that. There are rare instances, and when I do, it's usually to do online piecemeal restore, which is a killer feature. But yes, go ahead. Is there a number of IOPS per core that we should be looking for? SAN vendors like to focus on IOPS. IOPS, the higher number of IOPS, oh, this is kind of sort of tricky. They can make IOP numbers go crazy big by making each operation be very small. But that doesn't matter with the maximum consumption rate stuff because we're doing large operations. We're doing these big, long table scans. Where I am worried about IOPS is very heavily transactional active databases, OLTP stuff, and we talked about why I want to fix that with memory, not with storage. If my fix for OLTP servers means going back to storage continuously, I've already lost the game. All right, so in respect for the next speakers as they come in, I'll go ahead and finish up here. If you have more questions, I'll stand over here and take as many questions as y'all want. Thanks a lot for coming today.